You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at Milwaukee with a new online encyclopedia about the state's largest city. Now, in an order last week, Governor Evers directed all public and private schools to close by today. The order comes as Wisconsin responds to the growing number of illnesses due to the global COVID-19 pandemic. Experts say limiting contact with others can slow or stop the spread of the illness, but the closure of schools will have a big impact on daily lives for students, teachers, parents, and child care providers. Our next guest is here to share the latest on how districts around the state are managing worries about the coronavirus outbreak. Mike Thompson is the Deputy Superintendent of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Deputy Superintendent Thompson, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Before we get into the impact of the decision to close schools, can you briefly tell us what went into this decision?
Well, I think that is a question most appropriate for answered by the Department of Health Services. But I can tell you what went into this decision was the governor in directing the Department of Health Services to close was related to the coronavirus and how schools can do their part in reducing the spread of this particular virus.
How are districts around the state handling this closure? What kind of things are you seeing when it comes to trying to cover instructional time, for example?
I will say I have been very impressed in the action districts have taken around addressing this particular issue. And as we all know, this came on very fast from Friday, late Friday, to the direction to close schools by the end of Wednesday of this week. Some districts decided to close earlier and closed on Monday. But districts have been working vigorously over the weekend and since then to provide how to provide continuity of learning activities for students, how to account for some of this instructional time loss that they know is going to happen. And they've done it in a variety of ways. Some are putting together virtual environments, some putting together packets for students. Not only are they trying to provide some continuity of learning for kids during this time, they're trying to figure out how they can keep kids fed who depend on schools, as you know, for getting school lunches and school breakfasts at this time. So they have put some tremendous opportunities together for kids in a very short time, and they will continue to try to address this particular issue. As you know, the first emergency order directed schools to close Wednesday at 5 o'clock until April 6th. That now has been extended, that schools will be closed for the duration of this public health emergency, which simply means that April 6th date is very fluid.
What kind of guidance are you working on from the Department of Public Instruction for schools who are maybe in some cases scrambling to try to figure out how to maintain, as you said, that continuity of instruction?
Yeah, we have a very, I think a pretty well-developed webpage around virtual learning and giving school districts a lot of resources around virtual learning. Last year when we had the polar vortex, many districts kind of went down this road of trying to thinking about how do we provide learning for kids when we're closed for an extended period of time. Nobody could have anticipated this virus closing schools for this long, but many districts have been talking about over the last year how to provide these resources. In the stories I hear from a lot of districts is the community is stepping up, how they can help to provide extended learning opportunities for kids as this goes on. So it's really been a kind of a collaborative effort in communities to see how they can meet these needs. I can't think of a district that's not thinking about how to provide some continuity of learning for kids.
We know we have some parts of the state with a lack of access to higher speed internet in rural areas, affordable internet also in some urban areas. Is that going to be a roadblock here trying to get equal access to education for all students?
Absolutely. That is one of the challenges districts face. Many districts have more resources to meet the needs of kids for a virtual environment, and some districts do not have that. It does create challenges. There are a lot of efforts trying to reduce those challenges, how to get more internet services to different areas, how to provide hotspots, so to speak, for people that don't have internet services at home, how to deploy computers where in the past computers weren't available. But it is a challenge, and it's not equitable across the state. And so districts are doing the best job they can to provide these particular resources. And some will actually provide resources in hard form. They've had times when people come through the school building and drive through and pick up enrichment packets and different types of things. So The services they're able to provide will vary from district to district, and they'll do the best job they can to provide whatever they can during this, really, this unprecedented closing.
The state of Washington is, sadly for them, ahead of us in this story, and I've seen concerns there about students who are receiving individualized educational plans for one reason or another. What kind of questions are you looking at to make sure that those students don't get left out?
Yeah, that's a great question. That is one of the issues districts are now, that is one of the challenges districts are facing of how to provide, to the best of their ability, resources for all kids in this particular time, and how, and they're going to be talking about these issues over the next couple of weeks. As I mentioned, this just came about quickly, how they might possibly be able to meet some of the needs of our neediest kids that come to our school buildings. We're getting a lot of guidance, and we're getting a lot of questions answered from the U.S. Department of Education around how different ways districts can meet the needs of kids. And they'll do the best job they can on this. I think it's pretty early to see how those needs are being met, but we're in constant collaboration with the U.S. Department of Education and how they can meet federal IDEA requirements and trying to provide as much resource to districts as we can in a short period of time.
We're talking to Mike Thompson, Deputy State Superintendent for Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction, looking at the impact of school closures and how districts around the state are responding. Deputy Superintendent Thompson, we have this mandated minimum amount of educational time, that X number of hours in a school year. That's going to be a problem, and I understand the state is offering waivers now to districts. How does that work?
There is a provisional law that districts can request the state superintendent for a waiver of those hour requirements and extraordinary conditions. If this doesn't qualify as an extraordinary condition, nothing does. And we will waive those hour requirements so districts can really turn their attention to how they can, to the best of their ability, provide some continuity of learning for kids. So we have decided that we would waive those if districts need to request a waiver from the Department of Public Instruction around those hours.
I know there are also concerns about federally mandated standardized testings. How does that fit into all of this?
Yeah, we don't know how long schools will be closed. They certainly, we are entering the testing window for our assessments for kids in grades 4, 8, and 10, and we will, there's two requirements under testing. There's a state requirement for testing under state law, and there's a federal requirement for testing. We will need to request a waiver from the Department of Education around the testing requirements at the federal level so we don't jeopardize any federal funding coming to Wisconsin. We are pursuing that waiver as we speak. In addition, we'll work with legislative leaders in the governor's office to look at how we can, the possibility of suspending the requirements under state law for assessments during this particular school year.
I know in a lot of institutions, not just in education, there's a question of, okay, are we deciding this at the local level? Are we looking up to the state to set our guidelines? Are we looking to the federal government? How much guidance are you looking to give to those individual districts from the state DPI?
We're trying to, at our particular level at the state, we're trying to coordinate with other state agencies and with the governor's office to get information to school districts and clarify that information as quickly as we can. The state, from my perspective, the other state agencies and the governor's office have been very responsive and accessible to clarifying questions as they come out. And sometimes the directives and the conditions change by the hour, and that we provide what is required at the state level. And local communities are doing it at the local level. They're the ones in the best position to decide how do we now meet the needs of our kids in our local community? How do we gather around that? We certainly get guidance and mostly recommendations from the federal level around continuously provide services to kids in the school environment. And we pass that along to school districts that in turn help them make local decisions on how they're going to serve their kids. So it's a combination of all three working together. And at the state level, I've seen a tremendous amount of collaboration between state agencies and a tremendous amount of collaboration in local school districts around what they can do to meet the needs of kids.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I'll let you get back to it.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Mike Thompson is Deputy Superintendent of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. He joined us today to share how Wisconsin schools are dealing with the statewide shutdown. Next, if you're curious about Milwaukee's history, there's a new online resource to help you out. We'll find out more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after 12 years of work, the first stage of a new online encyclopedia about Milwaukee's history is now complete. We'll find out what it covers and what's planned for stage two. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about envy.
For those of you who use a wood-burning stove to heat your home during the winter, you understand the never-ending task of keeping wood burning and your pile stacked. Chris Hardy writes about the feelings he has about other people's wood piles during these cold months.
The airwaves are always bombarded with commercials touting the latest and greatest pharmaceutical offerings, but I have one malady for which no drug can cure. You never know when it's going to strike. I'll be driving down the road watching the scenery, and bam! I'm instantly overcome with jealousy and covetousness, and almost a feeling of resentment towards someone I've probably never met. I confess that I have woodpile envy, and I'm particularly attracted to very large woodpiles, no doubt because I'm ashamed at the size of my own. It seems that no matter what I do, my cordwood simply doesn't cut it. For as long as we've lived in the country, we've burned wood as our primary source of heat. And it's not that I don't work at it. It seems like I'm cutting wood all the time. The chances of me cutting a full heating season of wood a year in advance are the same as swine developing winged flight or Lucifer strapping on a pair of ice skates. Properly seasoned firewood should have at least a summer of heat to dry, preferably a year. When that's not an option, I look all winter for dead trees to cut, because they are partially dry, even if it means walking through waist-deep snow. For many years, we burned wood inside, but now we have a wood-fired outdoor boiler, which heats water that is piped into the house. All the fire risk and mess stays outside. It's also the perfect stove for wood-cutting procrastinators, as it burns any sort of wood, wet, dry, old, ugly. If it fits in the stove, it burns. The stove, which heats two homes and the milk house on our old dairy barn, holds 1,000 gallons of water and has a firebox that is 4 feet long, 28 inches high, and 32 inches wide. One of the advantages of having a large firebox is that I usually cut and split the pieces only to the size that is necessary for me to lift them. Sometimes I overestimate my strength, and those end up smoldering away in the front of the firebox because that's as far as I can toss them. The stove is a firewood nympho, always hungry for more. I've never really figured out how much, only that it's at least 1.5 pickup loads a week, more when it's bitterly cold and less during the shoulder seasons. But just how much does it need? Well, let's do the math. The average wood burning season is about 6 months, every day from November through March, and at least half of October and April. The wood stove requires at least 3 fills a day during the colder months. The math tells us that the firebox holds about 25 cubic feet. No one ever stuffs the firebox completely full. So accounting for airspace and ash buildup, let's say it gets filled with 37.5 cubic feet of wood a day. A cord is the standard of measurement for a pile of wood, 4 feet high, 4 feet wide, and 8 feet long. At 37.5 cubic feet of wood each day, a cord of wood will last only 3.5 days from November through March. That's 35 cords of wood to get through those months. And many years, I'm having to burn wood into May. So, conservatively, I need 41 cords just to get through the heating season. It's hard to achieve, much less maintain, a large wood pile when the demand is so great. Dealing with woodpile dysfunction is difficult, but I'm ecstatic when the fire lasts longer than 4 hours. Michael Clements, a veteran woodcutter and burner who lives near Middle Ridge between La Crosse and Cashton, recently gave me a better idea to help lighten the load, in more ways than one. Never split wood bigger than your wife can handle, he said. I'm not so sure my wife will warm up to that idea.
Chris Hardy is a writer based in Jackson County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, how much do you know about Wisconsin's largest city? There's Lake Michigan, the Brewers, the Bucks, beer, manufacturing, Summerfest, ethnic festivals, Laverne and Shirley, and a long list of famous and influential people. We could go on and on. For those who want to know more about these and other people, places, and ideas that have made the city what it is, there's a new online tool from UW-Milwaukee that you may want to check out. It's called the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee. Work began in 2008. They've just finished up the first phase with nearly 700 entries. Joseph Walzer is an associate lecturer in the Department of History at UWM and the project director of the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee. You can find the encyclopedia online at emke.uwm.edu. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on to talk about the project.
This is years in the making. I'm guessing it feels pretty good to have at least part one up and online.
Yeah, it definitely does. It actually, I mean, as you said, after 12 years, it kind of feels a little surreal that we're at this point.
Now, walk us through what the website is like. I took it for a spin, but tell people what they're going to find when they get there.
Sure, yeah. So as you mentioned, it is an encyclopedia. So there is 700 entries. That's kind of the base of our project and of the content of the website. But we also have a significant amount of images, maps. We also have some essays talking about the process of building this knowledge over time. We also recently developed a digital bibliography that will also be available for researchers to then take this research on and go and do new things with it.
And this is really A to Z, which for Milwaukee could be Aaron, Hank, to Ziegler, Frank. How did you decide what kind of people, places, and things to include in the opening round?
Well, that was, you know, of course, a difficult process of trying to parse out what we were going to include and what we weren't. We actually had a pretty excellent editorial board that we developed very early on in the project for about 2 to 3 years. They took the time to develop a list and kind of parse through what was going to be important, what was going to be included, what was perhaps going to be folded into larger, theme-based entries, and where the project would go from there.
And you tried to be really encyclopedic about it. This is not just a couple fun facts about each thing. You tried to do some pretty extensive research and verification of everything you've got on there, if I'm reading it right.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So each one of those entries had to go through, you know, of course, the process of selecting what was going to be talked about, but then also assigning authors. And our content was written by scholarly researchers, of course, from the area, the university here, and a great partnership that we had developed with Marquette University, but then also area schools, and then some other folks who are experts on these subjects and these subjects in Milwaukee throughout the United States. But then also, this wouldn't have been possible without collaborations with local community experts. I'm sure that we're familiar with the name John Gerda, but also folks like George Wagner, Carl Baer, Yance Marty, Ruben Harpole. I could go on with that list. But then also...
Talking to Joe Walzer, direct project director of the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee. You can find that at emke.uwm.edu. Sorry to interrupt there, Joe, but I wanted to ask the why question. What led you and your colleagues to want to tackle this big project telling the story of Milwaukee?
Well, for two big reasons. First of all, we're addressing kind of a shift in urban history, away from this urban biography model that kind of tells the story of a history from its birth until the present, and kind of this one singular line of its development, which ends up kind of leaving out a lot of stories that are really important to think about in that development that don't get treated as being part of its mainstream. So a lot of stories get left out. A lot of people get left out. And the other key piece of this was thinking about how Milwaukee has really been left out of the story of urban America. And it is really a central place for that development. You know, New York, of course, gets a lot of attention. Los Angeles, Chicago, you know, and for good reason. I mean, they are our largest cities. But Milwaukee has been a key place for urban entrepreneurship in the brewing industry and the leather industry and machine production, but also in its workforce and in its political movements. You know, it's an experimental site for municipal socialism. And then also more recently, a really important site of more conservative movements like school choice and things like that.
And Joe, in our last minute-ish or so, what's next? Phase one is done, but your work is not done, I don't think.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of our content, what we learned along the way is that, you know, even though we were relying on scholarly researchers and community experts to build our site, we were also offering lots of opportunities for students to have professionalizing opportunities to develop content themselves. Actually, more than half of our entries were written by graduate and undergraduate students. And they did that with faculty mentoring and the editorial process and fact checking. So they were able to produce these really meaningful pieces of history in the process. So we wanted to really capture that opportunity. So one of the things that we're going to be doing is we're building a companion site that's going to be offering students an opportunity to curate primary sources. So that's really the stuff that history is made of, the letters, the documents, the images, and give students an opportunity to really kind of contextualize those things for our readers. We also want to develop a series of lesson plans and curriculum for area teachers to be able to take this local history knowledge into their classroom. But not just that, but to build curriculum themselves, because they're really the ones who know what their classrooms need and what their students need.
We'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
All right. Thank you very much for having me on.
Joseph Walzer is an associate lecturer in the Department of History at UW-Milwaukee. We talked to them about the new online encyclopedia of Milwaukee. You can find it at emke.uwm.edu. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to the leaders of two of the state's biggest school districts about how they're dealing with school closures and an uncertain future. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, companies whose products we spend time on every day, like Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Instagram, they're paying attention to where we're clicking and what we're buying when we're online. Sometimes that means that advertisements that we see are more relevant to us. You might find something on an ad that you actually need and want to buy. But our next guest says these big technology companies are gaining control over us and our free market. We're buying things under the influence, and our decisions as consumers are being manipulated, sometimes even without our knowledge. Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget and runs its program Capitalism, Technology, and the Economy. Her piece for the April issue of The Atlantic is called Capitalism's Addiction Problem. Maya, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks. It's nice to be with you today.
Well, you've been on our network a lot over the years, Maya, usually talking about the federal budget, the deficit, the national debt. What steered your interest in this direction, the addictive power of technology and the impact it has on our free market?
Yeah, good question, because it's an odd path that got me here. And I should say that, of course, in the midst of all the huge thing that's going on in the country and the world right now, I realize it's not where everybody's mind is. But technology also is at the center of how we're dealing with what's going on now. So I'll pull those ideas together. But what happened for me is I've spent most of my career working on nonpartisan fiscal responsibility, the deficit and the debt. And it's always been a challenge. How do you get lawmakers and the public focus on some of these harder, long-term issues that you don't see and feel every day, but are affecting all of us? And out of that, I've spent more time over the past years looking at what's going right in capitalism and what's going wrong. It's kind of a hot topic as people think about income inequality and mobility and those issues. And there's a lot of questions about whether capitalism's working, but as I thought about that and I looked at the experiences we as consumers are having with technology, I kind of went back to my basic economics and realized a lot of things about the business models of technology, which is to get us to use the products more and more in ways that are actually having more effects on our brains than most things. It's having more of effects on our cognitive abilities and dopamine, which is what loops people into these things, the more that's threatening how basic markets and capitalism work. So while we have a lot of issues with capitalism right now, is income inequality too high? Why is mobility so low? We can address all of those within capitalism. But some of the issues that are coming up with how we use our technology and how those business models work actually are going to make capitalism and markets much more difficult to function. And I just wanted to start ringing the warning bell about it, not because I'm anti-technology. I actually think technology is incredible and has the potential to unlock so many of the things we need to think about. But I want to make sure we're using it wisely and thoughtfully and don't go down any dangerous avenues about how it's affecting us and our overall economic system. So that's a long path of how I got here. But I think it's a really important topic for our leaders in the country and us as citizens to start having conversations about.
Let's take your argument a couple pieces at a time here. And let's start with the idea of being addicted to the internet, whether it's buying stuff or social media. This is something that people talk a lot about, but a lot of times it's, okay, if I am addicted to social media, that's a me problem. You say it goes beyond the individual and it's kind of built into the system. How so?
Well, addiction is a tricky topic, right? Because there are many things out there that some people get addicted to and other people don't. And there's always been a discussion of whether if you just exert enough willpower, you can overcome it. And I'm pretty sure there are a lot of us as parents who are home right now with our kids suffering with that general question of how do you make sure your kids aren't on their screens all day long? But the pull towards these things, it's bigger than just, oh, I like using something a lot or I'm somewhat dependent on it. There is an effect it has on our brains, and more so on some people's than others. But what happens is technology, many of these programs are offering us really tremendous services, so much information, so much entertainment, so much connectivity. But we're building a lot of systems on them where we start getting dependent. And then we're using them more and more in ways that they are structured, and I'll go through how, where they are actually changing the dopamine rushes. And this is kind of the central piece of it, but the dopamine rushes we experience, where you start finding yourself twitching because you want to turn on your smartphone and see if you got any alerts or if your, you know, your streak is going on Snapchat, all sorts of these different things that give us a little rush of excitement, even though if you take a step back and you realize, oh, somebody hearting your vacation picture is not really that exciting. But in the moment, you're kind of in that rabbit hole. It feels exciting. And so what's happening is it is structured in a way that is making us crave these machines more. It's taking more of our attention into these kind of isolated and many times frivolous experiences, so you don't really feel it at the moment. And what it's doing is detaching us from our families, our communities, our work, it's shortening our attention spans. And if you think that these smartphones and these platforms have been around for really just over a decade or so, and how much they've changed the way we live our lives, you know, you go through restaurants, when we are going through restaurants, you go out socially and you see people, their families on dates, actually on their phones instead of being with each other. People are sleeping with their phones. The vast majority of us, I include myself, they sleep with their phones. We touch them 2,000 to 3,000 times a day because it's an impulse on something that's basically an extension of ourselves. And for the addiction component, it's basically as though, and I'm borrowing this from somebody else's idea, but it's like they put a slot machine or a flask of whiskey in your pocket because it's right there. That addictive substance is basically an extension of yourself, which makes it all the more part of your daily living.
Maya McGinnis is with us from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, where she runs the Capitalism, Technology, and the Economy Project. She wrote about a piece called Capitalism's Addiction Problem for the April issue of The Atlantic. Maya, okay, I get it. Maybe this is a problem for people if they're spending too much time on their phones. How does this hurt the free market? How is this capitalism's problem?
Yeah, right. So there are basic principles of capitalism that if you've studied your Econ 101 class, you kind of know, which is you need free and open information so that both sides in any transaction have enough information. They decide whether to buy or sell something or enter a contract. They can decide that. You need to have freedom of choice. And you need to have competition within these areas. And a lot of things, as you become overly dependent or in many cases addicted to something, you no longer can say no. And one of the games that I play, and I'm not saying my dinner parties are fun, but one of my favorite dinner parties games is, how much would I have to pay you for you never to use your smartphone or social media again? And you go through it, you think about it, and you realize, oh my gosh, you know, that's enough money for a car or a vacation or my kids' college. Like, the numbers are really, really high because there's something. And the good part of it is that we value so much we couldn't give it up. But the bad part is we couldn't give it up. Like, there is now something that you are unable to give up. And it's not just the usefulness. It is the attachment to it of how it makes you feel. It's the panic that you feel when you can't find your phone. It's the anxiety that you feel when you don't have Wi-Fi. And it's the risky behavior that we engage in when you pick up your phone and you text when you're driving. I mean, you see all the typical behaviors of addicts that are coming in these situations, and it is a loss of choice. So what it means, the result is, one, we're willing to pay astronomical prices. Though I'll return to this. We actually aren't charged them. One of the interesting things is we're given many of these products and services for free, and the way we pay is not in prices but in our data. But some of the threats to capitalism are the willingness to pay so much. The fact that these companies, because they track our movements, so much of our data and our information, their pricing then becomes tailor-made to us. You might be a really good discriminating driver of what is too much to pay for an Uber. And I might just be, whatever, it's on my credit card. I barely feel like it's real. I'll pay a ton of amounts for Uber. And we can start receiving different prices for Uber or different prices for Amazon and all sorts of things like that. And how the market used to work is that oftentimes when you buy something, you'd get it for less than you're willing to pay. That's the surplus. And you would get the surplus, so consumers would come out better. Now that entire surplus is being wiped away and going to the companies that have more surveillance data, and that's going to be a big loss for consumers. And in the same way, there's actually, we're being tracked on how frustrated and annoyed we get while we're waiting on service calls, or how many ads they show before we click off of something. And companies are now able to give us the worst service possible before they lose us as customers. So consumers are losing in both the pricing and the service areas of economics in some places. And the concern is that can keep on happening.
We're talking to Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. She runs the program there, Capitalism, Technology, and the Economy. We're talking about her piece for the April issue of The Atlantic. It's called Capitalism's Addiction Problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think you are addicted to technology? Do you think people around you are addicted to technology? And do you think our use of technology is the fault in some ways of these big high-tech companies? Have you ever bought a product or spent more money on something because of targeted ads coming to you or algorithms? Do you think there's an imbalance of power because they know all the stuff that you do and you don't know what happens behind the scenes in what they do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation with Maya McGinnis. She's president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget and runs its program Capitalism, Technology, and the Economy. Her piece for the April issue of The Atlantic is called Capitalism's Addiction Problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this kind of technology addiction in your daily life, in your family, your coworkers, your kids? Do you feel manipulated sometimes, as our guest says, it happens behind the scenes in programming, to keep coming back, getting those rewards for the little blip that pops up on your screen on whatever your social media platform of choice is? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. We'll start off with Jeff calling us from Superior. Jeff, hello.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, I want to share this. My life is pretty much an open book. I'm on Twitter and et cetera. And the way I feel about it is this. I'm almost 60 years old. Everything is there. I'm loyal to certain companies. I actually value my relationship with these companies because they collect data on me from 5, 10 years ago. They're able to tell me things that I've forgotten. And I see that as a positive. I don't see it as a negative. And I'm not afraid that they collect my data or what I'm doing. I'm entertained by it. And I value that as a relationship. I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Maya, Jeff feels like he's getting some good out of this.
Well, that's the perfect question, because this is not a black or white situation. This is not these companies are bad and they are doing bad things at all. The point I hope we start a discussion around is this is really nuanced. A lot of things are happening that we as consumers are not very aware of, and it's changing very, very, very quickly. And I want not a pause, but a like, let's stop and think and discuss this. So that's a great point about the upside of this, that there are entities that now actually have, they're better at tracking our history than we are. In some ways, technology is the new diary, right? People don't need to journal anymore because there's a tracking of it out there. And that's incredibly useful. And a lot of people also say, I mean, please, my life is an open book. I have nothing to hide. So why do I worry about it? But these issues of surveillance, knowing where everybody is at any moment, and I'm not saying, oh, it's because you need to hide where you are, but the notion that that power is being collected and, importantly, sold to people who we don't know, we have no say in that. So Jeff doesn't know who now has his data, and that data can be used in macro algorithms that actually track our behavior and then can push our behavior in one way or another to influence people. And the point I would make is not that it's bad, but that we need to have more sunlight shown on where it's going. We need to understand where it's going, how it's being used. And this applies to both technology and biotech areas. If you think about all these tests for people's DNA, incredibly helpful to have DNA and more ability through biotechnology to do research. And this is a moment where we're painfully aware of just how important that is. But you also need to know who has your medical data and who has the data of your whereabouts and who, when you give your retinal scans in the airport, who owns that data, who's using it, who it's being sold to. Because there is a lot of, we know, disinformation in these venues and sorting of sort of who gets what different information. And what you don't want is that powerful amount of information combined with AI to be used to manipulate people against their own will. So it's more about transparency than saying, oh, somebody having your data is bad. It's we need to know the full story. If consumers are going to have sort of all this openness, the companies also need to meet that with the same amount of openness about how the data is being used.
Jeff, thanks for calling in. We'll go now to Pepin us in Milwaukee. Pepin, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. What really worries me is the how available that data is for use in this cyber war that we find ourselves in. In particular, I'm worried about hostile foreign actors or even hostile domestic actors using that information to basically wage psychological warfare on the American populace. And, you know, I would really like to see Facebook and other companies really step up right now, or they need to just go away. They need to be dissolved, turned into multiple different companies or something.
Mm-hmm. Pepin, thanks for the call. First his concern and then maybe his solution there, Maya.
Yeah, well, it's a great point because right now is one of these moments where I believe we're seeing technology really step up and use its incredible resources, powers, connectivity, research capabilities to help in a moment of crisis. And so we know that this can be incredibly useful. At the same time, this is correct. The concern is correct, which is as these companies actually know more about our moods than we do, and they're more able to tell what triggers our moods. So if you have a smart TV that's able to track how you respond to humor, to violence, to sex, all of these things, you might not really be aware of it. You certainly didn't want some other company knowing about it. And that then means that things can be targeted towards you. Your mood can be affected by it. And again, I just want to point out, we're just at the very beginning of this. This technology has just been around for a tiny amount of time. But if you fast forward a few more decades, the immense power that will come with that will be tremendous. And so I agree. I think there's the real capacity for this to be done for good. And again, I think we're in a moment where we may be seeing a lot of good that comes out of it. But we have to be very concerned and protective about bad actors having access to that much data and that much ability to use it to manipulate people, to know things about people they didn't want shared or they didn't know about themselves, their economic preference. And again, the point of the article is their economic preferences, which was each individual's right to own. Without that ability to make free choices and have different choices and have market clearing prices that apply to everybody, capitalism doesn't really work. So they're just profound shifts. They're profound decisions to make. And to his solution, it may be that these companies are too big. I think the dependency on single infrastructure sources that provide that much information and connectivity may well be dangerous. I think one of the things we're seeing in the moment we're in right now is an over-dependency on different structures, supply chains right now, can leave you vulnerable. And you at least want to have a few main choices for where you're going to get your information, where you're going to get your entertainment, what platforms you're going to be using. The network effect shows that for a platform to be useful, it needs to have a huge amount of users. And then that really makes any other platform that does the same area not as useful. That's why Facebook dominates the space it dominates in. And so there may be a benefit if we can't figure out how to work through these thorny issues, saying these companies need to be smaller and have competition.
Pepin, thanks for that call. As we get into our last couple of minutes, Maya, are there other regulatory steps you'd want to be taken here?
I think the first thing is transparency. We need to understand, because the new currency of the technology area is data, not dollars, we need to know everything about where the data is going. This can't be a one-sided transaction. The second thing here is we're going to need a new regulatory and legal framework for technology, because right now we have both law and regulations that are really for the last century, not this one, not the infotech century. And so things like having very strong requirements against disinformation is going to be critical. Things like passing along your data with individuals should own their own data. And if we decide to monetize it, individuals should have the benefit of that, not companies. They shouldn't be trading it away without knowing the value. And we all do it. The annoying boxes click up and they say, click if you agree. And nobody knows what they're agreeing to. And they sell their data because they just want to read what's being offered there. But we need to change the way that works. And ultimately, we may want to go back to a basic economic model where instead of giving away all of services and platforms for free and paying with our data, maybe we should pay with dollars. Maybe we should bring back the basic, you pay Facebook, you pay Instagram. It's great to have them free, but if anybody believes they're really free, they're kidding themselves. So first, we need transparency. And then second, we need new controls over some of the places where this may be getting out of control. And that really has to do with disinformation and how our data is shared.
20 seconds, Maya. Thoughts for us, people who use these services?
Let's discuss it. The thought right now is some of these things are problems. Most of these things are opportunities. And all of this needs more discussion. And we all know we've gone through a massive change in how we interact with technology and what extent is part of our lives. In some ways, it's raising our children. It's a new member of our family. And we didn't really sign up for that. So let's take a pause, slow down, and have a discussion about how to use it productively. I actually think through this terrible crisis we're living through right now, we're going to come out with a new appreciation for both community and how technology can help us. And we can let those lessons start this discussion I think we need to have.
Maya, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's Maya McGinnis with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget talking about technology, addiction, and capitalism. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the head of a healthcare company with a big presence in Wisconsin tells us how care providers are ramping up their efforts to deal with the COVID-19 outbreak. Plus, we'll check in on the grocery store supply chain and how stuff is on the shelves still. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, a lot of people will be working at home in the days and weeks to come. Kate's guest shares advice on making the most of your home office time. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll find out what school leaders around the country are doing to manage COVID-19 with closures, online learning, and a lack of more specific guidelines from the federal government. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.